Remember that 1976 movie Network, directed by Sidney Lumet and written by Patty Chayefsky? Chayefsky had his character, newscaster Howard Beale, tell viewers to go stick their heads out of their collective windows and shout, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." I wonder how many people thought of this as prophecy. Fast forward a few decades and we have an entire industry devoted to telling us how outraged we should be and what we should be or who we should be afraid of. In their new book, The Outrage Industry, Political Opinion Media, and the New Incivility, Tufts University professors Jeffrey Berry and Sarah Soberai seek to explain why Americans are drawn to outrage and why it's bad for democracy. Well, they're both with me this morning to talk about the causes and effects of all of this outrage. Jeffrey M. Berry is John Richards Skews, professor of political science at Tufts, and Sarah Soberai is associate professor of sociology at Tufts University. Good morning to you both, and welcome to the Joy Cardine Show.
Good morning.
Morning.
We'll try to keep the outrage to a minimum here.
It'll be too hard.
Well, to paraphrase a line from another fictional movie character, President Andrew Shepard, the outrage industry often seems to be devoted to three things: making you mad about it, making you afraid of it, and telling you who's to blame for it. Does that sum it up at all?
Sure. Actually, I'm not sure what movie that's from. I know
The American President.
Oh, The American President.
Yeah, which was the precursor to West Wing, but we don't need to go there.
Right. Well, all three are correct. It is, the business model is to make you angry about the other side, to vilify the other side, and to get you so emotionally hooked that you come back the next day to watch or listen to the program.
So you have this phrase, the outrage industry. What exactly does that comprise these days? Sarah Soberai, could you answer that for me?
Sure. Well, we look at it's spread in several different places, but we look primarily at cable news analysis shows. So if you think of programs like The O'Reilly Factor or The Rachel Maddow Show or Glenn Beck's work, which we find now formerly on cable but now on Blaze TV on the Internet. We also look at political talk radio, of course, which is very popular. Most people, if they're familiar with the industry, think first and foremost of folks like Rush Limbaugh, but there are also liberals like Ed Schultz who are talk radio folks. And also we find it in online, you know, across political blogs as well.
Mm-hmm. And how did this develop? I mean, we've always had anger in opinion media. But it's gotten completely different. What's the difference now? And how did this all happen, Jeffrey Berry?
Yes, we've always had anger. You're absolutely right. It's a tradition that's part of a democracy. Free speech engenders this, but today is different. And what happened? What created this industry was not that Americans changed, but that technology and public policy changed. So in particular, the changes that led to cable TV and the Internet reduced the barriers to entry. It's an economic term that means, you know, how difficult is it to enter a market? Well, it used to be very difficult to enter the television market. ABC, NBC, and CBS had an oligopoly, and it was just prohibitively expensive to create a competing network. Once you had cable, what you had was channels that could reach you very inexpensively. The barriers to entry fell, and advertisers could reach the people they wanted to in very efficient manners. So the niche audiences on cable had an attraction to advertisers, and that enabled them to flourish. So this is a business. Advertisers find consumers through it, and that changed dramatically, and that changed American politics.
Right. So, if I could add to that, if you think concretely about television, like Jeff was saying, when there were three networks, the programming strategy was to choose the content that would be what they call least objectionable, what would offend the fewest. And so they were trying to draw in a huge audience. But when you have hundreds of cable channels or, you know, increased number of radio options with satellite radio, for example, and the Internet, when you have so many spaces, the strategy in order to draw an audience shifts somewhat. And so you're looking now for tiny slivers of the audience. And so being offensive, you know, the appropriate level of offensive or shocking is actually a really good strategy to get someone to stop when they've got the remote in their hand. So that's something that would have been unthinkable in 1970, for example, as a programming choice, now is actually clever and profitable.
So how do you compare shows that contain, for lack of a better term, actual outrage, shouting on the air, to other shows that you refer to in your book, such as Rachel Maddow's, where the general presentation is actually quite calm?
Actually, we would take issue with that. We found plenty of outrage on Rachel Maddow and MSNBC. Is really has the same business model as Fox, that the level of outrage may be a little bit less, but they are trying to attract their viewers by vilifying the opposition, in this case conservatives and the Republican Party. So liberals and conservatives both are attracted to this. What is different is that it appears to be more attractive to conservatives. The amount of outrage outlets is denser on the Republican, on the conservative side, particularly on talk radio. So for us, as we analyze it, we use the same code book, the same means of counting, to put it simply, of left and right. And we found that it was present in both sides of the ideological spectrum, but higher on the conservative side.
So other than differences of scale, then, you would say there's really not much difference, if any, between how this is approached from the left and the right?
Well, there are some differences in the form, but not as much as you might think. So as you referenced sort of the outrageous behavior, the yelling, or Glenn Beck was famous for, you know, tearing up in his emotion, because it's not just anger. Sometimes it's fear, or, you know, it's all about sort of generating an emotional response from the audience that may be anger or fear or moral indignation, for example. But so there may be more of one type with a particular host, whereas somebody else like Rachel Maddow does a lot of mockery or belittling. You know, that's sort of a very popular mode on her particular show. But if you look across the left and the right, we looked at 13 different ways that outrage could express itself. It might be yelling, it might be mockery, it might be use of obscene language, for example, name-calling, that sort of thing. There really isn't a huge difference between the two sides, though there is some variation among shows. But as Jeff said, you know, there is considerably more of it happening on the right.
Is there... When we talk about all of this, if you actually look at the total numbers of people who watch these television shows and listen to these radio programs, and you compare it to the entire population of the United States, let's say, and thanks to the internet, these things are really global, but we have to put some boxes around this. If we take a look at those numbers, it's really a pretty small fraction of the actual population that consumes this material.
No, that's not really the case. We have an estimate of the daily audience.
Okay.
This is the aggregate audience. So if you watch Glenn Beck and you watch Bill O'Reilly, you count it twice, but this is the number that's important to advertisers. The daily figure for cable television programs of this type, talk radio programs of this type, and political blogs of this type is 47 million. That's a lot of people.
Okay, it's a lot of people, but there's 300 million people in the United States, which is where I was going with this. And so but what happens is these people all talk about each other. And so all of these shows reference each other, and you have this sort of echo chamber going on. And so doesn't that actually multiply the real effect of some of this beyond what we might have seen years ago?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's kind of interesting with the echo chamber concept is that a different set of researchers found that when you are immersing yourself in sort of ideologically narrow media consumption choices for your political information, what happens is not just that you're less likely to hear information that contradicts what you sort of already believe, but that when you do encounter contradictory information, you have almost like a force field around you. You're sort of much less likely to accept it as possibly true. So it does for those people create somewhat of an insulation against other opinions, and that's concerning, certainly.
Mm-hmm. So how does this industry work? I mean, we've seen examples of what happens. We saw the recent flap over the Melissa Harris-Perry comments about Mitt Romney. We had, as you referenced in the introduction to your book, various statements that have been made on the Rush Limbaugh program. I guess we could go back to the flap over the Dixie Chicks and the remarks they made at a concert in London, which pretty much ended their careers in the United States. How does this industry work? What's its role?
Well, that's a great question, John. And let me pick up on your reference to Melissa Harris-Perry, because it's a great example of one of the ways this industry works, which is going to the edge and pushing the envelope and being controversial is actually a good thing, unless you go so far that you get fired, which happened to Martin Brashear, but that's pretty rare. So Melissa Harris-Perry, she and some panelists mocked a family photo of the Romney family in which there was one black adopted grandchild. This created enormous controversy. It was racial mockery, but it put her in the spotlight. She's a second-tier host. She's not doesn't have a regular primetime show. And for a week, there were articles in the mainstream press about Melissa Harris-Perry. So one of the ways you make yourself a figure and you attract people who are of the same ideological ilk is to be as controversial as possible, to be incendiary.
And it is true that they really feed off each other, as you're describing. So the folks who may have benefited most from that misstep on her part were the people on the right who enjoyed, you know, sort of the talkers on the right who really, leapt on this. This is exactly the way these types of programs function, is by on both sides, is by looking for missteps or perceive, you know, opportunities where someone's inept, and this can be the sort of media folks themselves or elected leaders, and they will take them and make them, you know, attempt to at least make them into giant scandals, regardless of the original, you know, sort of size. And so one of the things that happens on the programs is, though they're politically oriented, if one is watching a lot of them, you get a very, very filtered and ideologically selective view of what's going on in the world, where there may be a great deal of time spent on something that's relatively minor and very little time on a major policy thing that's in the news if it doesn't fit with their, you know, if it isn't sort of brand friendly, if it doesn't help their party, or I guess perspective, not party, sort of look better. So that's how it works. We think of it sometimes as like a political jousting with a scorecard where it's all about one-upping the other team. It's not really about sort of promoting, you know, a more educated populace.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a quick break, and we'll invite our listeners to join the conversation. How do you get your information, and why do you make those particular choices? Do you watch or listen to Fox, MSNBC, any of the outrage media outlets named by our guests? Are you a fan of some of the talk radio hosts that are often talked about in this regard? What do you think about outrage in the media? Does it make you more likely to watch or to listen? Are you outraged about all the outrage? And I guess I was unintentionally ironic. Well, no, it was intentionally. I'm sorry. We're going to continue this discussion in just a moment. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. And you can also find us on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine Program and leave your comment or question there. The book under discussion is The Outrage Industry, Political Opinion, Media, and the New Incivility. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with the authors of this book, Jeffrey Berry and Sarah Soberai. And with you at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Turn on your television, turn on your radio, look at a blog, read the newspaper. Man, there's a lot of outrage out there. There are a lot of people who are encouraging us to be angry, afraid, and blame someone for all that anger and fear. It makes a lot of money for people. There's a book about it, The Outrage Industry, Political Opinion, Media, and the New Incivility. We have the authors of that book with us. Jeffrey M. Berry is John Richard Skews Professor of Political Science at Tufts University and a co-author of this book. And his co-author is Sarah Soberai, Associate Professor of Sociology at Tufts University. They're with us today, and you can be too at 800-642-1234. We've kind of touched on this, but I'd like to use this question to kind of launch into the rest of the discussion. There's various media outlets have a lot to gain from providing all this outrage. There's a lot of money to be made out here, isn't there, Peter?
Do you mean Jeff?
Jeff, I'm sorry.
yeah, I can answer that. It varies across the business sectors of the outrage industry. Cable television is the most profitable part of this. For Fox and MSNBC, these two, their parents, Fox and Comcast, these cable channels are really moneymakers. They make a huge amount of money. The production costs are very low, and they gain advertising. So they're very large. They're actually among the largest profit centers of those huge conglomerates. Talk radio is profitable at the top end. Rush Limbaugh gets $50 million a year in salary, although he's been hurt by the Fluke scandal and advertisers pulling away. And blogs are the most interesting because they make very little, if any, money. They're really, most political blogs are supported by the labor of the owner-writer who gains a profit by the notoriety and the satisfaction of having people read him or her. But they don't attract much advertising. So the real motivation for a lot of bloggers is to try to become a political figure and make it and to migrate from the blogs to cable television and be a guest the way, say, Eric Erickson of Red State or Michelle Malkin of her blog have done successfully. Mm-hmm. Most, however, are not nearly as successful.
Let's take some calls. Pat in Richland Center is with us this morning. Pat, thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning. Has either of your guests ever heard of the Fairness Doctrine, a remnant of the pre-Ronald Reagan era?
We have, and that's the type of development that we think has supported this. So the elimination of the Fairness Doctrine is one of the things that has allowed programming like this to flourish. So the Fairness Doctrine didn't require that within a given program you had to show both sides or both perspectives, but you had to, across your programming, include different views. And so what that meant was that if you were going to have one politically oriented show that had a particular perspective, you were going to need to have another one. And so it was a costly endeavor during the era when there were not hundreds of cable stations. So now with that restriction eliminated, that's what's allowed something like Fox or MSNBC to flourish and to do well. So that's the kind of development, in addition to some of the media and the more technological developments, but there have been regulatory changes like that that have been very supportive of the development of this new genre.
Pat, if you're still with us, oh, I see we lost Pat. Well, I won't get to ask him a follow-up. In fairness to the Reagan administration, it looked like the courts were going to tell the FCC that the Fairness Doctrine was unconstitutional anyway, so that was probably less a public policy, a political decision to remove it than it was a legal one. But some people would like to see it come back. Would that solve this problem, do you think?
Yeah, well, it's not coming back. So, I mean, it maybe is a interesting hypothetical question, but there's no real support in Congress for this, and it'd be really difficult to fashion a public policy that somehow regulated this. So the toothpaste is out of the proverbial tube.
Sure.
There is a second policy, regulatory change, to build on what Sarah said, that helped to uncork the outrage industry, and that was the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which allowed radio companies to scale up and allowed concentrations of newspaper and radio companies together. So what that meant is that mom and pop radio stations in your local area disappeared as large conglomerates like Clear Channel Communications came in and bought them up and became pressured to deliver certain kinds of returns on investment to investors. So the long and the short of it is they had to look for higher ratings, and as the And as people migrated to MP3 and other forms of listening to music, talk radio was really the last cheap way of providing local content on the radio.
Well, it was seen as the savior of the AM band anyway, and not to get too far, into the legal and public policy weeds on this, but there were two other things that happened in the early 80s that most people don't understand or even remember, and that is that the ownership rules were changed so that at one point, if you owned a license, you had to actually operate the station, and that would have prevented a lot of major conglomerate ownership.
Right.
And the other thing was, if you owned a license, you had to keep it for either 3 or 5 years. It was 5 years, I think, in 1933, but it was reduced to 3, and that kept the speculators out of it. And those two changes were what made what happened in 96 even more impactful.
Yeah. And radio stations are bought and sold now like commodities.
Yeah. I mean, trading stamps. It's right. Someone who's been in radio as long as I have, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
Right. And so these programs are in syndication, which for, is an affordable way to get programming that draws an audience. You know, so you have Hannity or the Ed Schultz show, you know, on multiple radio stations.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to, first of all, we've been talking about kind of what this is, but what's the harm here? So we have, we live in the land of the free and the home of the brave. We're supposed to be exercising our free speech rights and no laws are being broken. Although some would say that what people are calling, crying fire in a crowded theater. But, so what is, what harm is being done by all of this outrage, do you think?
Well, there are three main things that we're looking at. I mean, at some level, we don't want to say that, you know, there's no good that comes of it. We see some evidence in other research that this type of content makes people more interested politically or perhaps more likely to be politically active themselves. Unfortunately, though, that activity also may be based on very low information quality. I think an example that jumps out to me over and over again is that when the death panel myth circulated, which happened large around the proposed healthcare legislation, the circulation of that myth was very much a product of the outrage industry. And Pew Research ultimately found that 30% of Americans believed that they were real, that they were part of the proposed healthcare plan, and 45% of those who reported watching Fox News believed them to be real. So misinformation is one significant consequence if we expect that people need to make informed decisions on their own behalf when they go to the voting booth. But we also think that it's disconcerting that we find that people may be less tolerant and less open to having political conversations with the actual people in their communities, you know, reluctant to talk with people who they have labeled as them instead of one of us. So it makes sort of that very vital democratic practice of talking about politics and solving problems locally in your community much more challenging. And perhaps most significant at the national level is their relentless stigmatization of collaboration and compromise for those people who are in Congress. So, and Jeff may wish to elaborate on this, but legislators are well aware that their votes are going to be read as measures of party purity, essentially, as ideological purity, and that changing their mind or collaborating is something that's viewed negatively by these folks, and they may have to answer for it, and that's not terribly desirable. I don't know, Jeff, if you want to add.
Yeah, I'll pick up on that. That's a really good answer. So a great example of what Sarah is talking about is the government shutdown in October, and a lot of people wondered, you know, why are the Republicans doing this? It doesn't seem rational. In the end, they got absolutely nothing out of this. They had to capitulate, and actually cost them a lot in the polls. But from the individual, perspective of the individual congressman, it made sense because they were worried about Republican Congress, and they were worried about getting a primary opponent. And so this test of purity, even though it had no immediate benefit to public policy to the nation, helped to prevent them from getting somebody in a primary who could defeat them the way that some of the less conservative senators and representatives were defeated in 2010 in primaries where they received a Tea Party opponent.
You mentioned the Tea Party in your book. You write that it gained enormously from getting heavy focus from the outrage media. Is there any analog on the left that's benefited in the same way?
There's the mobilization on the left has been, I think, relatively weak. There was the Occupy movement, and Sarah's actually more of an expert on that than I am, so she can pick up on this. But that lasted a little bit, and then sort of evaporated into the air. There is still some lingering anger, and income inequality is becoming an issue. So, you know, public opinion is there. But in terms of actual mobilization of organizations developing and working closely with talk radio, there is not an analog on the left. That's really something that happened on the right, where talk radio became the communications network of the emerging Tea Party in 2010, 2011, 2012.
And what about the Occupy movement, Sarah? And you might want to throw MoveOn.org in that mix as well. What about those?
Yeah, I mean, MoveOn's been very important for organizing on the left, but it's not the type of organization that we were studying. We didn't look at sort of these 501c4 type groups in our research. But one thing we can see when we look at one of the things that I think Occupy and the Tea Party illustrate really nicely in terms of understanding how this industry works is the mirroring, the fact that the left and the right do things very similarly when they're engaged in this type of behavior. So what we could see when the encampments, for example, were in full force, and when the Tea Party was particularly active around that same period in the healthcare discussions, was the way that the left would speak about the Tea Party and the right would speak about Occupy in incredibly similar language, where you could almost, you know, one side, depending who you're talking about, these are patriots who are doing, you know, valiant work on behalf of their ideals, right? If it's your group that you're talking about, or they're dangerous, they're misguided, they're confused, and, you know, they're a disaster for democracy. So there are moments when we would look at that, the text, say the transcript, or hear them live, and it was remarkable how similar the language was on both sides, that you would have discussion of the left-wing extremists versus the right-wing extremists, and so on and so forth. So for our point of view, I think one of the things that was interesting is to see in that example the similarity across sides.
There's a comment we have on Facebook from Susan, who writes, "The news programs now are entertainment programs. When they aren't having angry rants, they're hyping stories for ratings with dramatic music and vivid graphics. They report on rumors instead of investigating. They have panels of talking heads in which everyone is mic'd at the same time instead of taking turns and calmly explaining their positions with professionalism and civility."
Yep.
Pretty well describes it.
I think I would, I mean, I personally agree with that. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that CNN's Jeff Zucker recently came out and said that sort of a straight news model was no longer sustainable in this news ecosystem. And so what he was describing was that CNN, which is a station, a network that we had considered as sort of more traditional or conventional compared to, say, MSNBC or Fox, in that they were striving for neutrality or objectivity. You know, of course, these are ideals that don't actually exist, but striving toward that. And yet he's come out and say that CNN's going to be remodeled and will have a quote-unquote new attitude. And I'm really curious to watch how that develops. So I think that what we're going to see is simply more of this type of development. I don't see personally any sign that outrage is on the decline. It's on the increase at the same time that things like newspaper readership are plummeting, and I think it's concerning.
Mm. Well, and there's really no niche that we can call radical moderate either. So
oxymoron.
Yeah, not likely to happen.
One thing that I think is interesting about that is what you might expect is that given the plethora of cable channels and radio stations, for example, with all this political content in space, that maybe you'd see, you know, a more broad range of perspectives, a Green Party station, a Right to Life network, a bigger range of what's out there. And instead, what we tend to see is, you know, pretty straight, you know, left versus right. And I think that's explained in part by the need to gather eyeballs and clicks and ears, and that's who's sort of out there in the public. But it also speaks to media's reluctance to innovate, that what tends to happen is that when there's a model that's successful, they replicate. That's why we have Law and Order SVU, Law and Order Criminal Intent, you know, that they're looking to sort of capitalize on what's been working. And so if what you have is a successful Rush Limbaugh, then you're going to have more programs in that vein because profit is at the forefront because these are businesses.
Let me pick up on your comment about moderates, John, because I think that's really an important point. So one reason why outrage is working so well these days is the polarization of our political parties. And what has happened over time is not that more Americans became polarized. There might be a slight increase. There's still plenty of moderates out there. There are more moderates than there are conservatives or liberals. But what happened is that the parties sorted themselves out over time, starting in the civil rights movement when blacks were empowered and were able to vote in large numbers and moved into the Democratic Party. White conservatives moved out. Liberal Republicans left the Republican Party for the Democratic Party or to become independents. And so over time, what's happened is the Republican Party became much more conservative. The Democratic Party became much more liberal. And so this fits into this model of us versus them. And moderates have lost power within both parties. And that is reflected in the kind of language and the kind of vilification that you see when a guest like Ted Cruz goes on Fox and starts to talk about the Democrats.
Well, I mean, you had Richard Nixon went to China and gave us the EPA. I don't think he could get elected in a Republican primary, assuming he was still alive and was interested in running again. But, I mean, Richard Nixon, or let's go even farther back, Eisenhower couldn't get elected dog catcher in the Republican Party today.
Right. People didn't know whether Eisenhower was Republican or Democrat around 1950. Both parties went to him and asked him to run for president. He chose the Republican.
Yeah. So, I mean, things have changed. But we say we hate negativity on TV, but our behavior suggests otherwise, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. We are going to take a short break. We're talking about the book, The Outrage Industry, Political Opinion, Media, and the New Incivility. I'm going to talk about the difference between what we say we want and our behavior. It's often they're often at odds. And we'll take a break. We'll come back again. We're discussing this issue until the top of the hour. You can join us at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR, or on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine Program. Jeffrey Berry and Sarah Soberai are my guests. They're both professors at Tufts University. We'll continue our conversation with them in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's a billion-dollar-plus industry. It's the outrage industry. We're talking about it this morning with the authors of a new book with that in the title. Jeffrey M. Berry is John Richard Skews, Professor of Political Science at Tufts University. Sarah Soberai, Associate Professor of Sociology at Tufts University. So research says we hate negativity on TV, but do we really? If we hate it, why do we tune in so much? That would be the next question. And Jeffrey Berry, why don't you go first on this and then Sarah?
It's engaging. It's compelling. You sit and you watch it, and just as Sarah said earlier, you don't hit the TV remote to go to the next channel because you get caught up in the language and the emotion, and it plays to your guts. This is a scientific enterprise. That is that people who work for the network study how people react, and they know what gets people angry, what gets people to stay on the station rather than switching. So this is very much giving consumers, or at least some consumers, exactly what they want.
Well, but I guess, again, you know, we see a lot of times where people say one thing but want another. We say we want a better Congress, but we keep voting the same people back in again. And we also like to watch train wrecks and things like that. I've heard the term bread and circuses used. We could go on, but why?
Well, I think one of the things that's tricky to know is that we have audience numbers that suggest very large audiences. It's difficult without additional research to know exactly why those audiences are watching. So, for example, there may be, we spoke to, and I can talk in a second about that, fans of the programs who identify as fans and learned quite a bit about what they like about the programs. But for the broader audience, it's difficult to know. Is this simply the best thing on? Are they watching it because the diner has to be satisfied with the menu, as the old saying goes? Or is it something else? Are they watching it to make fun of it? Are they watching it because they want to know what the other side thinks? So it's a little bit difficult to know exactly how they're interacting with the content without doing sort of a large quantitative study of the audiences themselves. It may have to do with the time that they're available and that's the thing that they find most interesting. And they may be consuming it with a much more critical lens than we suspect. Having said that, there is a definitely powerful contingent of diehard fans, and what we learned in talking with them is that in a time when political conversation is very scary, and there's a glut of social science research that shows we really only like to talk about politics with people who we already know agree with us, and we tend to do it in the privacy of our own home. So it's a very intimidating proposition for folks. They don't want to be judged negatively. They're trying to avoid conflict. There are a lot of things they find risky or scary about those discussions. And what we learned talking with the fans and watching the programs is that these shows systematically erase all of those discomforts and give the viewer or the listener or the reader a place they can go where instead of feeling challenged, they feel validated, they feel flattered, that they can hear, it's almost like going to church, right? That they can hear the things that they believe articulated in a charismatic and dramatic and colorful way and leave feeling fortified. And so it becomes somewhat of a safe haven for those who consider themselves fans, a place where their ideas are safe, where they're not going to be judged negatively, and they're not going to get into conflict about the subjects.
Mm-hmm. We have a comment from a caller who couldn't stay with us, Mary in Duluth, who called in to say, 2 points, according to Nielsen data, cable news has only a tiny percent of viewers in comparison to the traditional evening newscasts by ABC, CBS, and NBC. Also, there is something else amiss, and I think it is a shell game. Control the topic and keep the public uninformed. What do your guests think about this?
Was it Mary that wrote that?
Yes.
She's correct that the largest cable show is the O'Reilly Factor in terms of audience. It's 3 million a night, and that's still smaller than what you would find for ABC, CBS, or NBC Nightly News. However, its impact is amplified because it continually makes the mainstream press. So if you look at Politico, for example, almost every day they have an article about what somebody in the outrage industry has said about whatever the topic of the day is, something usually incendiary that's creating controversy. You know, when's the last time that Brian Williams made Politico saying something incendiary? So what he says doesn't go out through the mainstream press. So it's not an exact comparison to just look at audience numbers, but it is a small part. It is a smaller part of the public, but it's an ideological part of the public, and it's a part of the public who goes to the polls and votes. So they're not your average Americans. They're much more politically engaged, and their impact is greater.
Well, and that's and I think that's a great point, because that's one of the things that feeds this. These people go to the polls and they vote, and that's why politicians are paying so much attention, isn't it?
I think so. I think that's very important in terms of what Jeff was saying earlier about fearing primary opponents, certainly. But what I wanted to add related to if you're comparing network to cable is that it isn't exactly a perfect comparison. So if you look, for example, at Fox and MSNBC versus CNN as it has been traditionally, you know, sort of a more neutral cable sort of news option, we don't find that pattern. What we find is that at the moment that Glenn Beck was transitioned off of Fox, I think that was in 2011, he was transitioned off of Fox. At the time he was taken off, he was regularly tripling to quadrupling the ratings of Wolf Blitzer in the same time slot on CNN. So if you compare across sort of neutral or conventional news versus these more outrageous news sources, opinion venues on cable, we find a little bit of a different story than if you compare network to cable.
Mm-hmm. And how big a factor is time slot? I mean, O'Reilly is on during prime time. The evening news is on during the supper hour. Does that play a part in this at all?
Prime time is the golden time for MSNBC and Fox. CNN has really struggled in that time zone. But the 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and to a slightly lesser extent, 10 o'clock shows are the ones that really count. The rest of the day on cable, there's very few people watching. It's just a tiny, tiny audience. So it's really those 3 hours where cable makes its money and makes news and the mainstream news through its ability to generate controversy.
Let's take another call. Let's go to Barbara in Waupaca. Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Yes, I really do not like the anger and the outrage. And so what I often do is I will possibly listen to these speeches and things, but I go to fact check mostly. And I go to political somewhat, but I really trust fact check. They have, they back up with what studies, et cetera. So that's what I do for my news. And whenever I'm talking to people about it, I try to say, well, let's look at fact check, because I really don't want to get into arguments with people.
I wish more people did that. That's fantastic. The problem is that for an organization like Fact Check, or there's, what's the other one, PolitiFact, Jeff?
Yes.
PolitiFact, I think. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. PolitiFact,
so
that's it.
There are a few, but they can't possibly keep up with all the misinformation that's circulated. So both Jeff and I would love to see more of that existing, you know, more perhaps even public funding for that type of endeavor, so that there is some barometer for what is in fact accurate, what is in fact an exaggeration, what in fact is plain old misinformation. And then, of course, if we had those, we would need people like you to go and check before they have a knee-jerk emotional reaction to what they've heard.
We have there's just so much to discuss here in this book. We'll never get it in an hour. What is the role of genuine emotion in political discourse? I mean, there is some. We're passionate about what we believe. We have genuinely strong feelings about things like access to abortion or a right to life, or we do have these feelings. What role does genuine emotion have in political discourse?
Well, it's important, and it varies across the population. Some people don't care about politics at all. Presidential election with a high turnout in the United States is 60%. So there's a large part of the population that doesn't get emotional enough in that sense. And that has consequences, because non-voters are different than voters are in terms of the views that they hold. That the latest research shows that. So emotions are very important, and that's the way that this industry operates, because it plays on your emotions. It uses coded words. It makes you angry. It gets you involved through that. Earlier, Sarah was talking about what, you know, this is a safe place for fans to think, and what we found, think about politics. And what we found in conversations with fans is that they talk back to the radio and they talk back to the TV in their head. They're often saying, yes, that's right. You're right, Rush. You're telling it like it is. And it's a place where, what one of our findings is, a place where white conservatives can feel they can talk about race or hear about race in a candid way, where they feel uncomfortable talking about it in a more general public situation because they feel they're going to be castigated by expressing conservative views.
What about go ahead.
If I could just add a little bit on emotion, I think one of the things that's really important about emotion, neither Jeff nor I thinks that emotion in politics is a bad thing. And there are many times that emotion has a role, that there are impassioned speeches that are, I mean, if you look at any of the, you know, major national events, the civil rights movement or 9/11, I mean, emotion is vital. It's part of who we are, and it's how we connect to the things that matter to us most. What makes the outrage industry different are the techniques used to sort of deploy emotion. You know, it's a different set. If you're using things like name-calling and ad hominem attacks and misrepresentative exaggeration and conspiracy theory to stoke emotion and sort of manipulate people, that's quite different than someone who is expressing very powerful feelings about an issue like gun control or abortion or something like that. So I think that we are in no way interested in having some sort of, you know, it couldn't exist anyway, emotion-free political discourse, but instead wanting to call attention to sort of the financial or the political economic underpinnings of the way emotions are used in these outlets.
So how should the media approach topics that are genuinely emotional, and what model should replace the outrage industry? How do we get there? Let's spend the rest of our time talking about that.
Our position in the book is that we are benefited as a society by a variety of news outlets and commentary outlets. And these, a lot of these things are not, you know, we keep using the term news. It's really not news. It's really opinion commentary where people are expressing their views on news that's already happened. And one of the dangers of the outrage industry is that for some people, news and opinion get conflated, and they mistake something like the O'Reilly Factor for news, which it's not. It's commentary on news. So we should have both commentary and straight news, and people should look in ways, look for media that is more objective, that is not ideological. And if they want more and they want some opinion and commentary to go along with it, that's fine. But relying exclusively on the outrage industry, we think, is dangerous. As Sarah pointed out, you end up with misinformation and you base your opinions on what you think are facts, but were really opinions based on people who are trying to draw you in for purposes of increasing their ratings.
Sarah, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I would most like to see is simply more diversity of opinion. So I think we would be benefited by having not just different levels of sort of passionate, you know, I would like to see, as Jeff say, more quality, say, investigative journalism or in-depth journalism that's available on TV and on the radio, but also different perspectives. So if we are going to have a broad number of talking heads, that they would represent a broader array of viewpoints and of people, of speakers. You know, these are predominantly white men, and I think that that's a flaw because that in no way represents the American public, right? It represents only a tiny sliver of the American public. So it would be better to have a wider range of political perspectives expressed by a broader range of people. That would be much preferred.
So what does the future hold here? I mean, is news and media coverage going to become more and more outrageous? Is there a point of diminishing returns on this that we're going to reach, and maybe the pendulum is going to swing back the other way? Or are we going to just see more and more of it constantly escalating?
The industry is probably crested, at least for the foreseeable future. There is an upper limit on this, and there are a lot of Americans that don't like this, as one of your callers indicated. So what we found is that the ratings on cable are fairly stable. They're actually down a little bit this year, but that's compared to an election year. On radio, there's been an overexpansion. Because of the decline of music on the radio, too many stations adopted talk radio because they would get the programs for free, the syndicated programs for free. And we're seeing a pullback there, and also advertisers have pulled away because of the Rush Limbaugh-Sandra Fluke episode. So in the immediate, in the foreseeable future, I don't see it growing, but also I don't see it going away. And it's, again, part of our American tradition, and there are a lot of people that like it. So I think it's part of the political landscape, and it's here to stay.
Mm-hmm. We didn't mention public broadcasting and all of this. Where do you see them on the continuum of the outrage industry?
Well, obviously, public radio and public television is as good as it gets, John.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that.
We do have something factually about the NPR, for example.
Go right ahead.
Is doing extremely well. So there is an appetite for high-quality, objective news. That has not gone away. More people read the New York Times now because it's online than ever before. So the nation has not turned into a bunch of blithering idiots who only go for the lowest common denominator of hateful talk. So there's a lot of Americans that still want quality news, and that's encouraging.
Okay. Well, that's a nice high note to leave us on. Thank you so much for your time and for your excellent book. Appreciate the conversation.
Well, thank you for having us.
It's been a pleasure.
Jeffrey Berry is John Richard Skew's professor of political science at Tufts University. Sarah Soberai, associate professor of sociology at Tufts. They are the co-authors of The Outrage Industry, Political Opinion Media, and the New Incivility. Christy Taylor produced this hour of programming and handled on-air production, and Bill Martins handled show direction. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. This time tomorrow, it's the Week in Review. You don't want to miss that. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.